And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, this last week was sort of a classroom exhibit week of how enablers work with each other. Alliances are made by people who need enabling and themselves can enable. So in our politics, we have Trump, who wants to desperately to get reelected president because it's very beneficial to him. He's able to make all kinds of business deals. He's able to get the U.S. ambassador in England to be a salesman for his Scottish golf course. And you have people like Stephen Miller and Bill Barr who need a president to enable them to impose the most horrible reactionary policies that have come down the pike, I don't know, maybe since Andrew Jackson. And we saw it in Portland with the attempt to set up a national police force with the first efforts in Portland. But unfortunately, all of these enablers are fantastically inept. And they do their best, but their best falls short. They never seem to be able to get it done, which is our good fortune. Right?
Well, yeah, but they keep trying, they do damage in between. If you remember way back when we started the show, I talked about labeling these folks regressives. And certainly the policies that they are looking at, their thought processes, are highly regressive. They go back really to the founding of the Republic, because the founders wanted to have a democratic republic with checks and balances and what have you. And these folks want to go back to authoritarianism and just pure power plays without interference. And we're seeing more and more of that, as you said, as the election comes closer and Trump becomes more desperate as he's starting to see the fact that it isn't fake news. It's not an alternate reality, that the polls are real, and that one of the reasons that his polls are the polls are real is because the people are rejecting his policies, and he doesn't want that. He wants both the policies and the acceptance of it, and he can't get it other than through these extraordinary means and attempts.
Meanwhile, just to show you how divorced from reality he is, last week, the unemployment rate zoomed up again. 1.4 million unemployed, an increase for the first time in 18 weeks. There had been a decline, although still a disastrous number of unemployed. But last week, it went up again to 1.4 million new claims. We're now up to 56.5 million people who have made claims in the last 18 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, it had gotten to the point where we were looking at between 1 and 2 million as almost a new normal, and thinking, well, that's a lot better than the 6.4 and the 4.8 that we had at the beginning of this. But it's still by itself a startling number. And, there was some braggadocio going on in the administration that the numbers were coming down. And they, of course, they've been only creeping down of late. They went to 1.8 and then 1.6.
And we should remember that the norm for unemployment in a healthy economy in this country is, 100,000, 150,000 a week?
Yeah, in a bad week, you might get 200,000.
Right. This is more than 10 times that number.
Right.
15 times that number.
Yeah.
That's how great he's managed the economy.
Right. Right. I mean, what you used to get were the opposite. The employment rates were going up.
Yeah.
Not the unemployment rates.
Yeah.
Were going up. But and so that is still happening. And of course, things are still shutting down. We're having that battle about shutting things down and not shutting things down. The reality hit the Trump campaign this week when he had to face facts and he had to shut down his convention in Jacksonville. If you remember, he started, he attacked the governor of North Carolina saying, you're not going to allow people to come here without these restrictions. We're going to leave. And he went to Jacksonville. And of course, they couldn't pull it off because Florida's governor listened to him and had, you know, these increasing, these devastatingly high rates of contracting the virus and deaths growing. And so he, you know, the reality said, and the Democrats long ago said, we're not going to be going to Milwaukee. And the Democrats proved right, and they should be crowing about that, that they were right and Trump was wrong as a political matter. You know, there was a small article a week or so ago that Lou Barletta, the former mayor of Hazleton, a former congressman who rode the anti-immigration wave, was going to be leading the Pennsylvania delegation in Florida. And of course, now he's leading it to nowhere because there isn't any delegation going. So, I mean, that kind of reality set into to the Trump folks.
But now this coming week, there's going to be, you know, there is more reality that's setting in for the American people that somehow or other the Republicans are going to have to deal with. First of all, starting Monday, the unemployment benefit of $600 is going to end, depending on what state you're in. And by the end of the week, it'll end throughout the country. The Congress has done nothing. In fact, McConnell sent everybody home for the weekend. It's no big deal for him. And the ban on evictions is going to end at the end of the week. And right. They're talking about 20 million people who are potentially targeted for eviction because they can't pay the rent.
Yeah. Again, this is a reality check. Let me just go back quickly and you know, talk about Trump's inability to pull something off. It came out late in the week that Trump was going to try to have a rally in Scranton again.
In Scranton?
In Scranton. Nobody knew about it, and it got canceled. His advance team got here, but it got canceled because they couldn't comply with the Pennsylvania requirements that Governor Wolf has put in. So, you know, good for us, I guess, that it wasn't there. But, you know, you getting back to the...
Where were they going to hold it in Scranton?
The Cultural Center again, where he came in March. That was his last rally before everything shut down.
But the Cultural Center is not that big a venue. I mean...
No. And that's why they had to shut it down. They were going to be limited to too few people. His advance team would take up all the seats, so he couldn't... Couldn't do what he's wanted. You know, he has.
Well, he would have an enthusiastic audience anyway.
Well, yeah. His audience, you know, he had the Tulsa debacle. He had to cancel in New Hampshire. He used rain as an excuse, but it turned out nobody was going to go to that. He can't go to Jacksonville.
The senators wouldn't go to Jacksonville to the convention.
Right. And now he can't even come to Scranton, which, you know, what do they used to say? You know, if you could play in Scranton, you can play anywhere. You know, back in the old vaudeville days.
Yeah.
He's not even doing that. But you know, we should get back to your main point there. Before I interrupted on his ineptitude and his inability to, you know, just pull things off. What they're the picture that he paints of America just isn't the picture of what people are seeing. First of all, he keeps talking about how the virus is, he's still talking about how the virus is going to go away. And all over America, particularly red America now, people are seeing that this is just phony, that it's hitting people. It's choking the hospitals. The death rates aren't quite as high as they were in New York at the height of this, probably because it hasn't been hitting the nursing homes like it did in New York City and New York State there. And New Jersey, but still, the numbers are enormous, and people are still over. You know, that's still an overarching issue, and his inability to handle that is one thing. He keeps trying to play on this crime issue, and really, except in certain isolated pockets, crime really isn't the concern either. You know, he's running, and I think I mentioned it last week, sort of on the Richard Nixon campaign, or you certainly, you know, when you talk about Roger Stone being the connection, the Law and Order campaign, but really it was the George Wallace campaign that he's running on. The problem that Trump has running on that is when Nixon ran in 68, there was a Democratic administration, so he could run against the administration. The problem he has now is that this is his administration. This is his America. So if he's attacking America as it is, he's attacking his own leadership. And they can't quite figure out how to separate those two things because they really can't be separated.
And that's tearing the Republicans apart, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, look at all of a sudden Liz Cheney emerges as some sort of an anti-Trump person within the Trump camp. She's an anti-Trump person like I'm an astronaut. I mean, she may actually be anti-Trump, but her policies are awful. And yet, congressmen like Matt Gaetz and other diehard Trumpists.
Jim Jordan,
they're busy campaigning against her, tearing themselves apart.
Yeah, and this was described this week in one place that I read as trying to figure out who is going to lead the new Republican Party after what happens in 2020, whether the folks that have left the Republican Party are going to, you know, including the Bushies now, if they're going to be able to reconstruct what was the old party, the pro-business, the country clubists, that kind of party, or whether it's going to be this new, the know-nothing type of party. The know nothings.
But what do you think? Do you think that the corporatists can create a new party?
Well, they got the money.
But they've always had the money. They always had the money.
Yeah,
and yet Trump outfoxed all of them in 2016.
Yeah, because you've got these the rogue billionaires, the ones who think they all did it by themselves. We're financing things. Now, I saw something late in the week also that the Mercers are sitting this one out, interestingly enough. They were the ones that really put them over the top. They're the ones that got them to hire Kellyanne Conway and to hire Steve Bannon.
Right.
Bannon was the Mercer's man.
Right.
But there are some of these billionaires. Peter Thiel isn't putting a lot of money into this either at this point. You know, we should put as an aside.
But the Mercers and the Thiels, these guys, they're Trumpists. They're Bannonists.
Well,
they're not the kind of Republicans you're talking about. That,
right.
You know, they're not the Chamber of Commerce types.
Right. But even they start to realize that you have to have a market for what you're selling. And you also have to have people who can run it. That's where the Chamber of Commerce comes in. They say, we've got to have people coming in from all over the world.
But they've actually sued the administration, right? The Chamber of Commerce?
Yeah.
Can you imagine this, that the Chamber of Commerce is suing the Trump administration because they're not letting immigrants in? Of course, the Chamber needs the labor.
Yeah, exactly. They need the cheap labor as well. But they also need if you looked at the lawsuit, they need the people on the top, the people who can, the scientists and people with, you know, really good heads on their shoulders to help this. And that's been the United States' main advantage over the years, as we've going back to what Alexander Hamilton, bringing in an immigrant who really can help the country succeed. In that way, they are more socially liberal than what you get of the Stephen Millers in the White House, people like that, and the populists. You know, there's a good article in the New York Times this week by Thomas Edsel, separating conservatives from populists and the authoritarian streak that the populists have. But the populists can't really run things, as we're finding out. They can agitate, they can destroy things, but they can't really run things because it kind of goes against their, and we'll get back to it, their abilities, what you said, their incompetence. And
but there are competent people who are dead reactionary. I mean, John Yoo is a, you know, you may say he's incompetent because you say he's distorting the law. But the point is, he learned how to distort the law. He's able to do it. He's able to create a legal argument that you have to spend time rebutting. But he's able to manipulate the law in that way. He's competent for that task. He may not be competent for properly understanding the law because he doesn't understand it as it should be understood. But he's certainly capable of manipulating it. There's got to be engineers who are like, you know, Albert Speer, who, you know how to be architects, know how to be engineers, know how to design whatever, know how to run things, and yet are dead reactionary, totally, you know, devoted to racism. There are such people.
They're cold to the human condition. They don't realize the effects it has on human beings.
Or they don't care.
As you said, they don't care about this. John Yoo was the guy who wrote the memo that allowed for torture.
Yeah. Which he defends to this day.
Yeah. And now he's written a new memo interpreting the Supreme Court decision on DACA.
He's clever. The DACA decision said that the president could issue the DACA decision. That is, not he could decide not to deport the DACA people, right? So what does Yoo say? Yoo says, well, if that's legal, that he doesn't have to enforce a law, then why isn't it legal that he can promulgate a law? And, you know, at face value, that's an argument.
Well, that's, you know, and that's a leap. I think that the only thing standing between that interpretation and it coming into effect may be John Roberts.
That's a hell of a weak read to rest the entire maintenance of the American Constitution on.
I understand that, but he has stood up before on those things that are so extreme. But as you and I were talking before, and you pointed out, John Yoo's argument is it'll take a couple years till it winds up in the Supreme Court, so in the meantime, you can do all the damage you want to do.
Exactly.
Which is what they really are intent on doing is doing damage on this. And you know, during the week, I've been trying to put my thoughts together to perhaps write an article. There's a certain mentality that seems to take great pride, if not joy, in human suffering. They really are immune to, as we've said, the real effects of what they do on human beings. We see this all along. You know, we're seeing this now in Congress, where they're not going to, where it's the Senate. Mitch McConnell has refused to bring up the law, a renewal of the law that stops evictions or renewing the law that gives $600 a week to people, even though it's been on his desk for 2 months. And you get this rugged individualism idea that everybody can pull themselves up on their own bootstraps, and if they don't, it's their own fault, their moral weakness and out of character. And, of course, these are the folks that are the biggest grifters, that take money from special interests and whatever to do this. And I think that when people start being thrown out of their homes, because these bankers are also kind of immune to it. Friend Tom Hartman always said that a lot of corporate heads are just sociopaths. You know, when they start throwing people out, how is that going to help the Republican vote? I can't see how it does. The only thing is people aren't going to have homes, you know, aren't going to be concentrating on voting. They're going to just be concentrating on existing.
That will help Trump continue.
Yeah. Now, I would say on evictions, Pennsylvania has a law. The federal law, because I work with Lackawanna pro bono, prohibited evictions on any property where there had been some sort of public aid. So Section 8 housing, you couldn't do it. If there was an FHA loan to buy a place or something like that, you couldn't do it. That's going by the wayside. But Pennsylvania has its own statute. and the governor did extend the moratorium on evictions. I'm not sure whether it's through the middle of August or until September 1st. So we're not going to be seeing that as dramatically in Pennsylvania, but you will see it elsewhere. The problem that the landlords have is if you throw people out, there's nobody that's going to take their place because there's nobody else that can afford to come in either without the money being allocated to them.
I know that, but, you know, landlords are peculiar people. You know, you go through towns and cities and you see many, many empty stores. And this is before the coronavirus. And you ask around and you say, why is this store empty? And it turns out it's empty because the landlord won't lower the rent. But when he doesn't lower the rent, it stays empty. The store could be empty for a year. Well, why didn't he lower the rent so that he could rent it? Did you mean to tell me no rent is better than less than you'd love to get? And yet, landlord after landlord acts that way. I've never understood that.
Well, it goes to mentality again.
Yeah, you got to win. I got to win on my terms.
Yeah. And that's, you know, and that's, it's a guy thing. It's more or less. It's the way that that they think. And again, it gets back to the folks that we were talking about, the Jim Jordan types in the Republican Party and their attacks. And
who's leading the fight against Liz Cheney?
Yeah. He's one of them. And of course, then you also have the misogyny of it, the woman hatred. This week, that broke out in Congress with AOC, where Ted Yoho, one of the
couldn't be a better name, right? Couldn't it? Could you have chosen a guy with a better name to be a foil? God,
he went up to her where there was press involved, and he cursed at her and called her the B word, the one that rhymes with witch, in public.
Yeah,
and she was more or less kind of letting it go until he got pressure. It got published. So then he got pressured.
Yeah, because there was a political reporter standing right there.
Right, right. So now it's public. So now he has to go to the floor of the House to apologize. And he gives one of these half-baked, not really sincere apologies, hiding behind his religion and his family and this or that.
And he has two daughters and he has a wife.
Two wife, yeah. And AOC asked for and was given an hour of personal privilege. She only took 10 or 11 minutes, but gave one of the more important and certainly the most tweeted speech in the history of tweets.
Is that true, really?
Yeah. Within a day, it was unbelievable about how phony this was and how it really was power and it was male chauvinism. And she didn't use that word, but that... he gave permission for people to attack his wife and his daughters and what this was about. You know, and it kind of remember when Ted Cruz tried to stand up for his wife and then went back to his supine position with Donald Trump. I mean, some of these guys just really don't have it.
Yeah. Her speech was terrific.
Her speech was terrific.
Yeah.
And it made her into a martyr, so to speak. Heretofore, the attacks on her were more or less because she was Hispanic. Now the attacks are because she's a woman, and that's a far more serious political blunder by these regressives. But there was.
They can't avoid it. They can't help themselves. They think it's right.
Let me tell you another story. Other women are speaking up, and there was a woman who was the a lieutenant governor of Alaska at one point. I don't know who she was. I can't remember her name. It was a few years back. And they were swearing in. She got to swear in the state senate or what have you, or the state office holders. And afterwards, they each had to come up to her, and she had to sign their paperwork and give them their certifications. And one state senator came up to her and said something to the effect of, you know, you should be home baking cookies.
Come on, really?
Something like that. Yeah, yeah. They asked women office holders, what was the worst thing that you've ever had done? And she came up with that one. So this, you know, again, this plays into the Democratic base, but we have to see that. I think to some extent this is part of the attack on Mary Trump. This was part of the what we saw with the Kavanaugh hearings on that. And the pushback.
Well, the Mary Trump business certainly backfired on the people who attacked her. First of all, they couldn't attack her from the point of view that she didn't know the guy because she's part of the family. She did know the guy. They couldn't attack her that she wasn't competent to judge his mental state because she's a psychologist. So they just, they didn't really have any way to attack her. And her book is the most popular book ever published.
Yeah. The quickest number of sales that they've had. It's amazing how that is. But, and all this just keeps tying back into this authoritarian macho personality disorder that we keep seeing come out over and over again. And it tends to, verify what some, I hate to call them pundits, I think they're more observers, I've been talking about over the last several years. You had the Snyder book on tyranny. You had Masha Gessen's book come out. She's a pretty conservative person, but she's had the experience of authoritarianism. And then this week we had published the book by Anne Applebaum.
Conservative writer. She's hardly a flaming liberal.
Yeah, The Twilight of Democracy. Yeah. I've ordered it. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But it's subtitled The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. And she's already written the article in Atlantic. It's on the cover of the the July-August issue about the enablers, the people who are complicit, in her words, on this. And those are important things, I think, to realize, to understand the psychology of this, because that's where we're really headed on this. And of course, Trump is trying to play on a different psychology, fear and smear. That's been the thing that we've noted in the past. And we talked about Margaret Chase Smith's description of the Republican Party in the 50s, with McCarthy being in that mode. Getting back to your question is, what's going to happen with the Republicans? We don't know. We know all of those folks that have left the party and are really getting under the president's skin, the RVATs, Republicans for Ethics, the Lincoln Project, the 43, the Bush 43 people that have formed a new group. We're going to have, in essence, I think at this point, two Republican parties: the party of the Jim Jordans and Matt Gaetzes, and the Louis Gohmerts. By the way, this week Louis Gohmert tried to outlaw the Democratic Party by saying that we shouldn't have any party that once supported slavery shouldn't be allowed to run for things. Having that party. And then the other party is this Chamber of Commerce party and the old-fashioned conservative Republicans that, let's face it, they did employ racism, but they were far more subtle about it, and they become far more savvy about how to handle things in that regard. The Chamber is willing to have people of different colors and whatever come into this country to work. So,
The Chamber are... all they care about is exploiting labor. They don't care what the color of the labor's skin is. In fact, when you talk about structural racism, it's the Chamber that enforces it, because they're the ones, their members are the ones who set up the structural racism. It's just how it works. But anyway, that's it for this week.
Okay.
We'll see what damage they cause next week. Of course, for sure it'll be damage.
And the only thing sure, death, taxes, and damage.
Yep. See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place. This program is supported by Argosy Bookshop of New York City. 116 East 59th Street, just down the block from Bloomingdale's. Old and rare books, prints and maps, members of the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, founding members of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, members of the Appraisers Association of America, on the web at Argosy Books, ArgosyBooks.com. Check them out for books, autographs, maps, and prints.